I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Wild Tales podcast. I'm Jason Fox, and this podcast is about amazing stories of adventure, resilience, and survival of every kind. The podcast is presented by the Book of Man and supported by Talisker Single Malt Whiskey. I'm going to be taking questions on this one from people on Instagram, and the top three questions that I read out, that I designate as the top three, they will get a bottle of Talisker 10-year-old. My guest today is Jay Morton, who you'll all hopefully know as the Mole in the current series of SAS Who Dares Wins. We have a chat about his career in the Special Forces, his mountaineering work, which has involved climbing Everest twice, and what the outdoors does for him. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, hello everyone. Wild Tales podcast with me, Jason Fox. Today, we've got Jay Morton, who is... he goes by many names, number four, the Mole, DS, but now Jay Morton as well, because he's a good friend of mine. Anyway, Jay was in the Parachute Regiment and in the SAS. Little bit of background there. I was in the Royal Marines. Jay was a para. There's not a lot of difference apart from they concentrate on throwing themselves out planes. We do a little bit on the water. We wash, they don't, and it goes on from there. But no, there's a lot of respect between the Royal Marines and the paras, and I've got a lot of friends that are in the paras. That's where Jay started his military career. But what we're going to do first is we're going to go back to the beginning, and you as a child, Jay Morton, what was he like?
Oh God, I was probably a horrendous child. I think like speaking to my parents, I always had a smile on my face, which I probably still do now.
But
I grew up kind of working class family. Went to school from Preston, the north, so I'm a northerner. And then kind of school, I always say kind of school didn't really work for me. Kind of didn't really enjoy working in classrooms and written work and listening to teachers, and kind of probably at school found all the topics pretty boring, which is quite ironic now because I'm quite interested in like history and geography and that kind of thing. But back then, like, didn't want to know about it.
Yeah. What was it like being a sort of a young adult in Tokyo Jews? So before Tokyo Jews, I'm now basically showing you that
your
I know age. Preston.
There's
a nightclub in Preston called Tokyo Jews. In fact, there we go. Tell us about that.
It's closed down now.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it's called Lava.
Oh, mate. Unbelievable. Anyone from Preston there that remembers Tokyo Jews?
That was like the big night, wasn't it? Tokyo Jews.
Yeah, I had a few mates from Preston, so we used to go out there.
I was going to say, we probably crossed paths at some times, didn't
probably.
We?
Probably. I probably knew you were a para and shunned you.
Probably smelt me a mile
yeah.
off.
Ran the other way. Why did you join the military? And what drove you towards the Parachute Regiment?
I guess, like, when I said, like, school probably didn't work for me, I was kind of probably an outdoor kid, enjoyed being in the outdoors, enjoyed playing sport. Went to college when I finished school to do sport, and again it was the same process of didn't like being indoors, enjoyed playing the sport, didn't really like doing the work, sitting down in front of a computer, like writing on pieces of paper, all that kind of bores me.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I kind of wanted to go into the Marines, funnily enough. And when I went into the careers office, the guy sat behind the desk told me that I had to do, I think it was 15 pull-ups to get into the Marines.
Yeah.
And I probably can't do 15 pull-ups now. Yeah. I mean, I probably can. I'll probably do about 30, but I mean...
Did 15 this morning, mate.
Did 15 for breakfast. But yeah, at the time, it kind of put me off. I could probably do about 3 pull-ups. I was a bit more of a runner when I was younger. And at the time, I had a mate who was in the paras. He was in 3 para.
Yeah.
And he used to come back at the weekend and on leave, and kind of spin his dits and tell his stories about what he'd been doing. And yeah, I guess that kind of just attracted me to going to the paras.
Yeah.
And I always kind of, I didn't want to join the army and, you know, end up being a fucking vehicle driver or a clerk or something that's, you know, I wanted to do, like, go in and...
Not that that's bad.
Well. Well. But I wanted to
have a bit of
purpose.
You wanted to be a soldier.
Yeah, I wanted to have a bit of purpose. And if I wanted to be a soldier, I wanted to be the best soldier. And, you know, I didn't want to be kind of second best like the Marines. So that's kind of what drove me to be a para.
It's funny you say that, actually, because I had a mate of mine who I... we didn't grow up together, but we grew up from a distance together, and we'd always talked about the military. He was keen, hell-bent on joining the Marines, and so was I. So we thought we were going to join up together. His name is Wayne Masters, actually.
I know Wayne Masters.
Yeah, he ended up joining. I remember he phoned me up, and he said, I'm joining the paras. And I was like, what? You've abandoned me? And he joined Free, but he ended up being tanks.
No way, yeah, I know Wayne.
Yeah, good luck. Big shout-out to Wayne.
Yeah.
So you joined the paras. Your brain was removed. You learned how to jump out of planes. How long were you in the paras before you then decided, and what made you decide to go SF?
Yeah, so I did 4 years in the paras, and kind of at the time that we joined, Iraq was just dying down, and Afghanistan was making the news a little bit. So did the first tour in Iraq in 2005, and it was during that tour that America... You know, it was in the news that America was going to be going into Afghanistan and the Brits were going to be supporting. And it was like umming and ahhing at the start, and we were getting pulled into briefs whilst we were in Iraq, and no one really knew what was going on. You know, no one had been in any real conflict in Iraq. It was more IED based, or, you know, and it was generally not targeted against the Brits. So no one really knew what was going on. And I mean, I was, you know, 19, 20 years old now. Didn't really care, to be honest, as you don't. And yeah, you know, the year after, time went pretty quick, and we got back from that Iraq tour, and I think it was, I want to say 3 months later, we deployed to Afghanistan 2006. You know, turned out to be pretty bloody 6 months. Lost quite a few people. You know, we did have an awesome time there as a unit and as a battalion. And then came back from there, and then 2 years later we found ourselves back out there in 2008. And the operation, like, wasn't as kinetic or wasn't as busy as the 2006 one. And it was kind of during that time I kind of wished that it was, but for the good reasons and not the bad. And we used to see, I think it was your guys, so the SBS lads, fly out on operations out of Kandahar. So we all kind of sat around, like, as you do in the evening, and we'd talk about, you know, maybe going on selection, and we're still quite young. I was 24, and there was a big group of us, I think 9 of us, that decided to go on selection when we finished that 2008 tour. And I kind of didn't really know what the hell I was getting into. Like, didn't know anything about the SAS, didn't know anything about the SBS. As you do, you're just a naive para, isn't it? And, like, all, you know, for anyone that doesn't know, you get brainwashed when you join the paras to believe that, like, the paras are the best thing ever and everything else is shit, which is kind of true, but yeah, you're kind of brainwashed, and you almost look up to, like, the SAS and SBS as being, for example, crap hats, we used to call them,
and that means someone that's not a para.
Yeah, so, like, you know, it's all reg when you're in the paras. I think 9 of us went on that selection in 2008, and I was the only one to pass.
Because, I mean, selection is, I mean, it's long, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the only way you can describe it.
I enjoyed it, though.
Yeah, you sort of you are left to your own devices, aren't you? As long as you can deal with your own head, isn't that bad, is it?
It's quite grown up, isn't it?
Yeah.
As in, you know, for each phase, as long as you're doing the work, you're left alone. Maybe not the jungle. You get thrashed in the jungle.
Yeah.
But the hills, it's like, it's quite nice, isn't it, to go out, you do your test march, you come back in, you eat shitloads of food because you just burnt so many calories, and then that's you kind of get your head down or do your admin.
There's no one actually shouting at you. There's no one saying you have to do this, you have to do that. I don't know if we've covered this before, but you just get told you need to be at a certain place at a certain time, and that's all you need to do. Okay, yeah, you've got to navigate. But the only thing that puts a lot of people off is they wake up in the morning, they're their only drive and motivation. It's raining, it's dark, cold, and miserable. And you see blokes, don't you? You just see people going,
rap.
Nah,
yeah,
I'm doing it. Which actually, if you're still there remaining, it gives you strength. Yeah, you get strength from it. It's like there's an old film from 1986 called The Highlander. And like it's a bit gory. And whenever someone gets their head chopped off, all the power goes from that dead person into the other person that did the killing. Now that's a bit, I don't know if it's
sadistic.
Is that all right? It's a film, but that's what I used to, on selection,
I loved Highlander.
It was called The Quickening. It was an awesome film. I used to say on selection, if I saw someone rap, give up. It's like The Quickening. I was like feeding off their strength and weaknesses.
I love the film The Highlander.
It was awesome.
But it was that, wasn't it? It was like you turned up, you know, you parade and it was still dark. It was pissing down with rain. You sat on your Bergen and I felt like they purposely made you wait for, you know, a good 30 minutes to, you know, an hour. Sat in the pissing rain on your Bergen, getting wet, pretty miserable before they turned around and asked if anyone wanted to VW. You always got people at VW, didn't you?
Yeah. And they've done the waiting already. It's like, what are you doing?
And if they were Royal Marine, they'd probably pack the kit about four times that morning. Already had about two showers. If they were para, they'd probably just a bit of deodorant on the armpits if you were lucky.
Oh, there was, you know, some of the paras actually got into bed in all their kit from the day before.
I did. I did. No, that was like disgusting. The best thing to do. You got more sleep. Because if you finished all your admin, and I took a little microwave with some like microwave rice, so in the evening you'd have like your main meal, and then I'd go back, and before I went in bed, I'd get like microwave rice out, put that in the microwave, bit of like pasta sauce, eat that, and then I'd put like my dry kit on for the next day and sleep in that.
Honking.
So that when I got up, I was just like straight out.
See,
I remember they'd get up at like, it's quite annoying because you sleep in these huge fucking big rooms. I don't know, there's what, 20 people in one room?
More than that, man.
So like if one person's up, everyone's up. Yeah. You'd always get the Marines getting up, and they'd have the foam roller out at fucking 4:30
a.m. I never did any of that.
Foam rolling and
what
doing
I will
yoga.
Say though is like there was, so everyone that was in, so I was in obviously in the Marines, so we did things slightly differently. We're a bit cleaner, but In when you're in the army, you sort of, the onus wasn't on washing. You could smell. That's why they're called pongos. Wherever they go, the pongos. And we used to get up, and the toilet blocks on the hills phase of selection are like 200 meters outside the accommodation block. And you'd wake up because you're drinking water all the time. You'd wake up bursting for a piss. And you'd be like, oh, as a bootneck, as a Marine, you put your towel on, put your flip flops on, scurry through the rain for 200 meters, have a wee. Come back. Not these wretched creatures. They'd just have an empty squash bottle next to them like that. Roll over, piss into the bottle, do it up. Some people even had industrial size ones that they saved up over a period of time. It was honking.
That's
anyway,
what I call good admin. I missed the piss bottle.
It was funny.
That's what I enjoy about the expeditions.
Anyway, enough for selection. You then went on, had an illustrious career in the SAS, which we obviously can't really talk about. Mm-hmm. How did you find daily life in the smash?
I used to love it, to be honest. Yeah. It's like a, you know, it's a dream job. It's probably a job that most men dream about. You know, and you get to do it. You know, it ticks all the boxes.
Yeah.
You know, used to pride myself on being able to do the job as best as I could. And I wouldn't say any day's the same, is it?
No.
Every day is different. And you know, each day has its own challenges or its own difficult points. It's also got, you know, I would say that the job is full of, and I would say most jobs in the military, but especially in the special forces, it's very, you have extreme highs and you probably have extreme lows, and it's like a constant kind of cascade of that, really, isn't it?
It's an emotional roller coaster.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I sort of not miss, but one of the things I did enjoy was like there is a lot of camaraderie in there in the squadron, a lot of banter.
I think that's what I missed when I got out, was just not being surrounded by that group of like alpha males that you know are all singing off the same song sheet, and like the banter and the crack that you have there.
A lot of people in that job in special forces, they sort of get to specialise in certain things. What was your speciality?
So like initially, I was a patrol medic. Yeah. So obviously when you join, you can either be demolitions
Which is what I was.
Which is, yeah. Or medic. So I chose medic, so specialised in that. I went into... So our squadron's pretty much... It's split into four. So you have a boat squad... a boat troop, a mobility troop, a mountain troop, and an air troop. So I went into... I basically wanted to go into mobility troop or air troop because I was para. And I turned up, I didn't get either. Yeah, so the one that I wanted to avoid was mountain troop because I'd never climbed. I wasn't scared of heights, but I think everyone has some sort of like wobbly leg at like high exposure. So for me, natural progression was from the paras into air troop. Anyway, ended up going into mountain troop, didn't I? So... you kind of specialise in your trade, which, you know, ours was mountains, so being able to operate and get a squadron or group of men over whatever kind of terrain it is. And then that kind of... I end up enjoying it.
You do, but just to throw a bit of background into this, you do get sent away on some awesome courses and you learn your trade really well, don't you, in that troop?
Yes, but, yeah, and like they do say like, It is the hardest troop just because you go away, do the Norways, you're constantly in cold conditions. It is the hardest troop. That and boat troop because they're constantly fucking wet.
But that's why I was boat.
Yeah. Like, boat's horrible though, isn't it?
It's
like, just wet all the time.
Wet and miserable.
And it's not even like you go anywhere nice. It's like the North Sea. Yeah. It's not nice. But so I ended up enjoying the mountain stuff and found I picked it up really well. I picked skiing up really well, picked climbing up really well. And we in the SAS, we send our guys off every 2 years to train in Germany to become mountain guides, military mountain guides. And I got picked and volunteered myself to go away and do that for 2 years. So I ended up becoming the SME in my squadron.
SME is subject matter expert, for anyone that didn't know.
Yeah, so I ended up being the SME in kind of all the mountain stuff within my squadron.
Cool. So, obviously, time in the SAS, went away, fought loads of stuff, did mountain stuff, did cool stuff, ups and downs, highs and lows. You then left. What year did you leave, mate?
2018. I had to think about that, didn't I?
A year
and a half ago.
18 months ago.
August.
Why'd you leave?
It was kind of a few reasons, to be honest. It wasn't just one deciding factor. I think the biggest reason probably was time and my time and how I wanted to spend it. You know, being the SAS, it's a very, very busy job.
Mm.
You're constantly away. You're constantly overseas, constantly out of your bed. You don't get time to develop and do the things that you want to do and that you have interest in. So that was kind of the main reason. Other reasons, kind of, I was still young, I was 34 years old. I still felt like I had a lot to give into something else.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt like I'd done everything within the Special Forces, or I'd ticked most boxes that I wanted to tick.
Mm.
And I didn't want to stay in or hang around to tick the other boxes when I felt like I could do other things.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So, I mean, Jay, just so people know, you left as a sergeant.
Yeah.
So a team leader within that organisation. So you're responsible for men. You're responsible for an awful lot, actually, as a sergeant.
Mm.
But then what happens is you sort of, the next stage is up. Your operational career, it slows down. Although you still get to go away, you're doing more admin type jobs, aren't you?
Yeah.
And a lot of people, that's good. It's good. It suits people. That's what they want to do. They want to keep climbing that ladder. You become a sergeant major. Or an executor, a squadron quartermaster who looks after stores and stuff like that. But when it comes to the actual job that you wanted to do as a young lad, it sort of starts to finish there, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly that. And it's like, you know, the best years in the SAS are like the first 2 years that you join because you're fresh-eyed, you're straight into it, and you don't really have much responsibility other than like to join in the stack and follow on people into the doorway. And it's like, that's the fun aspect of it. Mm. And then... Yeah, the longer you're in, the more responsibility you have. But like you just said, Foxy, it's like the more desk-bound you become you know, the prospects of being more desk-bound like become greater. I guess that kind of put me off. Again, I don't like desks.
No, I don't. We're sat in front of one now.
I know. It's a table.
Table, desk, tomato,
not a desk.
Tomato.
Desk have pens on.
Is there a pen somewhere?
Probably.
Right, whilst you were in, obviously mountains became your thing. If I'm not mistaken, your first Everest, were you still in the military?
Yeah, still serving in the
SAS. Right, because, I mean, that's a big fucking thing. Let's talk about Everest, number one.
Yeah, I guess, like, that's, you know, the quest to climb Everest started way before we summited. And it was an ex-regiment guy, John. He wanted to climb K2. And he kind of put it to guys in the regiment, and they said, look, why don't you take some regiment guys with you? So, you know, the kind of invitation went out. You know, I jumped on it straight away, as you would.
Yeah.
And then we sat down and we designed like a training program, or like a, you know, John didn't really have much climbing experience, so it was about a training program to be able to go from, you know, John was, I think, 47 at the time. He was involved in like a serious helicopter crash out in Afghanistan in like the early days, where he was left pretty fucked up. So it was about getting him to the summit of Everest, or at the time K2, but which turned into Everest. So we kind of looked at what we had to do. So it was basically some UK trips, some Chamonix trips, just to, you know, get used to wearing crampons, all that kind of stuff. And then we went out to climb a mountain in Nepal called Manaslu, which is the eighth highest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably this mountain that we probably learned a lot of lessons, as we did it completely wrong. As you do, your first 8,000er.
What'd you do, climb up it backwards? What's going on?
Sideways. Nah, but I mean, like, so if anyone doesn't know anything about climbing 8,000 meter mountains, you basically have a 2-month period, and within that 2-month period you'll get weather windows.
Yeah.
So generally, like for Everest, you're guaranteed one, you might get two, there's a slim chance of getting three. So you've got to get to that mountain, do all your prep, do all your acclimatization, get all your oxygen high, and be in a position so that you can attack when those weather windows open.
Yeah.
2 months. So we completely fucked up, flew out late, and we probably had a month to do all this. So we rushed, we kind of, acclimatization, you're supposed to do 500 meters a day. So we flew straight to, via helicopter, flew straight to the village that's below base camp.
Right.
Sits at about 4,700 meters, Samagaon, I think it's called. We sat there for about 3 days, decided to go up to base camp, have a look, came down. Second day, went up to base camp, and then we kind of started our acclimatization phase. At this point, you had all the other teams who had already kind of done their acclimatization. They were looking for a summit push. So we were like on the back foot already. Met some crazy Russian dude who came into the camp, and we thought it was like Russian intelligence services come to spy on us.
You can imagine all you lot were like climbing up, don't talk to him, he's a spy. He's trying to find out secrets.
He's trying to give us all like these, he had these like weird fried bread things that he brought with him.
Big laced with Hessian, vodka.
But yeah, we were like, he's drugged. I was like trying to hide him every time he was giving them us. He was nuts though, mate. He basically went for this summit push. He arrived to the mountain like 4 days late because he got held at customs. All his mates had climbed, they'd left his kit at camp three, so he turned up no kit, like nothing. So he popped his head in our tent because he could see it was people were in it, so we took him in. He just went one day to climb, had no idea where his kit was. When we went to climb, we were at camp two, and we were sat out one night, it was pitch black, I could just see this light in the distance. I was like, what's that? And like, as he got closer, it's this Russian guy. He couldn't find his rucksack, so he couldn't find his Bergen, had no kit. He'd attempted a summit attempt.
On his Jack Jones?
Yeah. But he had no like head torch, and all he had was his little, you know, like a Nokia 3210. And he had the light from this Nokia 3210. And he's trying to come down a fucking 8,000 meter mountain with this 3210. And then, so we're like, mate,
that sounds like me on New Year's Eve.
We're like, get in, get in. We're like, right, pitch your tent. we'll give you some food. So he's like, he gets his tent out. It's one of ours. He's stolen our tent. And the fucking line was snapped. But now going back to the original story, we ended up cracking this mountain way too late. Everyone had come off the mountain. There was us and a German team, which we knew. And I'd basically it was the first 8,000er, so it's, you know, it probably wasn't the time to do all the fuck ups, but we did it. Acclimatized really like wrong, so like John had really bad altitude sickness.
Yeah.
Probably to the point that like we should have gone back down, but we didn't. We grizzed it out. I think it was at camp 2. I've got a picture of him. Like he looks like he's about to die. But I thought it would be smooth climbing it, so I packed the right amount of rations. And I took no kind of, basically didn't pack any extra rations. When we got to camp 2, like the heavens opened up and we got stuck in this big snowstorm. And all our tents, we were supposed to bypass 2 and go straight to 3 where our tents were.
Mm-hmm.
So we had no tents at camp 2. Luckily, this German team were there. So we had three people in a 2-man tent for 2 days. And I hadn't packed the extra rations for it. So, as you can imagine, I probably had to get up, have a breakfast, and then that was me for the rest of the day. Like, you can't sleep because of the altitude. Just had a banging headache, like, dehydrated.
Hungry.
Oh, everything. Everything that you could ever imagine happened to us. Stuck in a snowstorm. Anyway, 2 days passed, and we set off to climb. And we were probably in knee-deep snow. So, malnutritioned, dehydrated, we set off in knee-deep snow. And if anyone's tried walking in knee-deep snow, let alone climbing, you'll know how hard it is. So we're all fatigued, all fucked. And anyone that knows Manaslu, it's quite avalanche prone. So to trigger an avalanche, the slope has to be around like 35 degrees. I think it's like 33.5 and between two sets of degrees anyway. And there's quite a few 35 degree slopes on Manaslu. Heavy snowfall, high winds, all big indicators of avalanche. Should have known, but you know, you get summit fever and all that kind of stuff. And so we set off trailblazing with this German team. Everyone's like fucked, everyone's fatigued. And we're going over these 35 degree slopes, and I was just like, you know, when you just like, yeah, you know, when it starts going, and like the old indicators are going up, and I'm like, I remember grabbing Mingma aside, like our Sherpa, and I was like, Mingma, I was like, is this safe? And he just looked at me and went, no.
End of conversation.
Yeah. At the time, I was like, I was struggling with the acclimatization, so I was quite, you know, everyone was ahead of me, I was quite at the back, so there's no way of me getting in front of people and saying, look guys, we should turn around here, should maybe call this off. So I cracked on with Mingma, and as we got up to, I think just past camp 3, we all kind of bundled up, and it was about this time I started looking around, and I just started seeing like areas that had avalanched. And like as we came up, one of the German guys was running back, and he's just like, mate, I'm off this mountain. He's like, there's too many avalanches happening. And as we climbed up to where everyone was, like literally the next bit of hill had all avalanched, and they were all stood on like the avalanche debris.
Yeah.
At that time, we decided to dig an avalanche block to test the snowpack to see if it was, I mean, I don't know why. I mean, all the indicators are there. You didn't need to dig a fucking block.
I don't know. Just a quick one. An avalanche snow block is basically, you can, it's a way of testing snow if it's prone to avalanche. And it basically means if it slips, you probably shouldn't go.
Yeah.
But there was no point because you've obviously already seen avalanches. Yeah. It's a token effort.
Yeah. All the indicators are there. And like looking back on it, it, you know, it makes me cringe talking about it because, like, you'd never do that in the mountains. You'd never do that in the Alps, but because it was like an 8,000 meter mountain.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a bit of that thing, you know, it's the first time you've climbed with Sherpas, and you put a bit of trust in them to know the local knowledge.
Mm.
And we dug this avalanche, this block, and the whole slope next to it, which we weren't stood on, slid. So at that point, I was like, I grabbed John because, you know, my safety was with John. I was like, mate, we're off this mountain. And we turned around and managed to get all the way back down to base camp.
So that was the build up to Everest.
Yeah.
Was Everest easier, obviously?
Yeah, no. And like, you know, we learnt all those lessons doing Manaslu, which was good in a way, because we could have a, you know, we could wipe the slate clean and we'd have a good start and a, you know, a good advantage when we went to come onto Everest. Everything was pretty smooth on that Everest expedition. And we didn't really have any mess ups. Like, I felt, you know, we acclimatized nice and gradually. We did 500 meters a day. Did one acclimatization rotation, which is where you go from base camp up to camp three over 4 or 5 days. I think it was 5 days.
Mm.
You come back down to base camp, where you sleep until you get one of these weather windows, and then you push up for the summit. And everything went really smooth. John acclimatized really well. We got up on the summit push, we got up to camp four. And at that time, I think we're on the second weather window. What you had is all these high winds, and camp four is like it's in like a big U shape. And you had all these like strong winds that just hit the side of the mountain and then just push up and come through this U shaped bowl almost. And they were pushing at like, you know, 100 mile an hour plus winds.
Oosh.
And we got up there, and it was quite a warm wind though, so, you know, your fingers didn't get too cold. But at the time, like, our tent that the Sherpas had erected was completely trashed from the wind. So we got up to camp four, trying to set this tent up. We managed to get the tent up, got in the tent, and we sent the Sherpas out to speak to all the other teams. And they came back in and were like, most of the teams are aborting, or they're going to stay another 24 hours and attempt tomorrow. There's like a big group of like really experienced Indian climbers that turned around and sacked it because of the wind. We're all like kind of sat in this four-man tent, all staring at each other, thinking like, what do we do? And we went to sleep, woke up again, and I remember just putting my hand out.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The window at the time, and I felt like the temperature, like the wind was still strong, but the temperature of the air seemed to increase. I don't know why, but it just felt like, you know, if we got stuck on the mountain and the wind was that strong, like maybe it's warm and we wouldn't be that cold, or I don't know what got into me, but I just thought, at least if we make an attempt, we've probably got enough oxygen, we're all pretty healthy, like no one's fatigued. I thought if we get 500 meters up and the winds were too strong, we could always come back down and attempt the next night. So we set off, and I don't know, you could probably count the amount of head torches going up. There was that little,
yeah,
probably about 10 people. We had three Sherpas at the time, and one of the Sherpas like couldn't climb, he was too tired, and the other Sherpa decided to give up just as after we set off. So John had a Sherpa, Mingma, and then I was free rolling. So I kept having it in my head that if I don't climb fast, this weather's going to come in and we're going to have no chance. So I like shot off on my own, probably passed about two or three people on the route, had the whole route to myself.
Yeah.
I tried waiting for John, but I just thought, I need to get up to the summit. Got to the summit about 9 a.m. so sun had come up. It was quite warm at the time, and there was two Korean climbers on the summit at that point. So I literally like ran up to him. I was like, "Mate, can you take a picture? I've got a flag." At the time, I had like the Squadron SAS flag.
Yeah.
So I pulled that out. They took a picture. They left the summit, and I was on the summit on my own.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
For like 30 minutes, I stayed up there.
I mean, that's pretty special anyway, especially in this day and age. There's a lot of people that go for that summit, and it's obviously rare to be on the top of the world on your own for that amount of time.
Yeah, it's like if you look this last year at the pictures that like our friend Nims uploaded, like the amount of people queuing to get on that summit.
What did it feel like, you know, when you were up there on your own? Was it, you know, how did that feel? Just were you like, fucking hell?
Yeah, kind of surreal, because you know, you'd invested all this energy and time, and you know, you'd sat down with me and John and designed this program to get into the summit, and you're finally on that summit, and not only like you're not even sharing it with anyone, you're just on your own. Just, I don't know, it's surreal. I was trying to make the most of it, which is weird. I was trying to like appreciate it or trying to remember it at the same time.
What year was that?
That was 2017.
Right, okay. So that was while you were still in. You came out, you left. You pretty much went in to work with Through Dark.
Mm-hmm.
Through Dark, for anyone that doesn't know, it's still a startup company, really, isn't it? High-tech, technical outdoor equipment. It's punchy in price, but it's punchy for a reason. It's properly technical equipment to be used by experts, really. What's your role then?
So I'm exped director. So I kind of deal with getting the brand on the mountain, testing, R&D, content, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So all the outdoor aspect of the brand, and then that feeds directly into the clothing and garments.
Cool. It is decent stuff, worth a look at. You've done Everest twice. You did it again last year.
Last summer.
So that was another one that was, I mean, that was busy period.
Yeah, it's different. Like, it's just two different experiences on the hill.
Mm.
And this last one, you know, Everest got a lot of bad press about the amount of people that climb it, and so it should do, really. But you know, you can never stop anyone climbing a mountain.
No,
and there's a reason that people want to climb Everest. It's the biggest mountain in the world, and it's like, how do you police that? Because everyone has the right, essentially, to climb that mountain.
It's no real different. If you go up to the Brecon Beacons on a sunny day, on a Saturday or Sunday, there's hundreds and hundreds of people climbing Snowdon, isn't it?
I know.
And Penny Fan.
Yeah, and you know, especially when it's winter and it's snowing, like people turn up in night trainers and that, and that's, you know, underprepared, and they just don't know what they're getting into, and taking selfies on the top.
It's sort of no different, just on another level, really, isn't it?
Yeah, costs a lot more money.
Right, I'm going to move on, because there's going to be a bit that a lot of people do want to hear about, and that is, early-ish last year, we decided as a team from SAS Who Dares Wins that we wanted to spice things up a little bit. We've spiced it up before in the past, but not on this level. And we wanted to introduce a mole, a spy, a snitch in the ranks. But this time we wanted to do it with purpose. So we wanted someone to come in and be that person, but who is from a special forces background. And the person that stepped up to the mark was you.
Yeah.
Jay Morton. Talk to me. I mean, I've got my own take on it, and that's not what we're here for. We're here about your take. So I'll tell you where we'll start off, because I do like this little bit. Let's start off with when we all turned up at the beginning of the prep period before the shoot. So we're all there. There's me, you, and Ollie and Billy, as essentially 5DS, building up, ready to start the shoot. But we all knew that you were going to be the mole. How was that for you?
It's fine. You know, I think for me, it was like trying to get that cover story right in my head, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I was constantly talking to
you. He was panicking.
Because I didn't know the people that were going on, or I'd never watched the show, to be honest. I probably watched like a few of them. I mean, I always watch the show. I've catched up now. But no, it's just trying to get that cover story right. Because I was saying to you,
well, you didn't want to blow your cover, did you?
No one wants to blow their cover.
You wanted to do well. No, but you, had, but you know, did. You wanted to be professional again, didn't
you? Yeah, because imagine if I'd have fucked it up.
Yeah,
I'm like, you know, there's a lot of weight hanging on my shoulders. You know, ex special forces guy is going to be the new DS. So, like, I had to get it all right. And I said at the start I was going to be a PT.
Yeah,
you were,
I remember.
Like, mate, don't be a PT. Everyone's a PT in there. And you know, I probably would have got caught out. But
there was a few PTs that have done it for a long time, so they sort of know it well, don't they?
Yeah. So I decided to go with a story that I was a factory worker from Preston, which I actually was back in the day. So it was
factory
easier.
Worker from Preston.
All right. I actually had to mimic. There was a guy in there from Yorkshire. Because I don't go back to Preston very much, so my accent's probably gone quite a lot. So I had to like listen to his accent and try and copy it. And at one stage, he's like, mate, are you sure you're from Preston? He's like, you sound like you're from Yorkshire.
You nearly rumbled yourself by trying to be clued too clever.
But no, I decided to go in as like factory worker from Preston. But
what kind of factory? See, I never really
Windows,
picked his
double,
story.
Double
about, oh, I did actually, didn't I? Yeah.
But I found it was that much of a boring job description that as soon as someone said, hey, what do you do? And I was like, factory worker from Preston. No one wanted to ask any questions.
That's not taking anything away from people that are actually factory workers from Preston
and from
that
Preston.
Deal with double glazing. Probably went to Tokyo Joe's back in the day.
Yeah, but it was funny because that day before I went and met all the recruits, that night, we were like,
This is the bit I'm trying to get to now. So just before, so he skipped forward a little bit. We're doing all the prep. We're all excited. We're going to look at all the different tasks and rehearsing and working out who's going to do what. And then we get to the point where, so what actually happened was me and Ollie were in a B&B just down the corner.
The snug.
You were in an Airbnb with Ant and Billy, and it was nice, wasn't it? You know, it was a nice little house. And then it gets to the night before the shoot. Now, obviously, me and Ollie and Billy are still allowed one more night in that accommodation before we move into the grim accommodation, but not Jay.
No.
Jay's now got to infiltrate, and he's shipped off. And I tell you what, he looked miserable.
It's horrible. That last night was horrible, wasn't it?
Yeah. We were all giggling.
Yeah. I just wasn't speaking. I was just silent. But we were sat down, like, finished a few bottles of red.
You?
Yeah, finished a few bottles of red at the biggest steak ever. And then, like, you know, 24 hours later, I was parading as a recruit in the hotel.
But you had to have dinner, didn't you?
With,
so the recruits aren't allowed to speak to each other, essentially, but they're allowed to have dinner and you sit down in pairs. Is that right?
Yeah. So they snuck me in that night. So I arrived probably about 11:30. So that, you know, you're trying to limit the amount of time that you can have a conversation with someone. Because that's like, once the show starts, there's not really much time to have a conversation with people to figure out much about them. So that was, you know, trying to minimize that time that I spent in the hotel. So I went to bed, woke up that morning, and everyone gets briefed that you're not allowed to speak to anyone. So I come
You're
down.
Probably like, ah, thank God for that.
I know. Like, hotel in the middle of Scotland. Like, no one really goes up there. The weather's shite. Come down for breakfast. And they were like, because everyone got told not to sit with anyone. So no one sat with anyone. So all the tables have just got one person on them. But like, there was no free tables. And I'm like looking around going, ah, fuck. I'm going to have to sit with someone. Oh, Big Jerome. Is he number 11? Or number...
He was number 18, if I think.
Number
if I remember
18,
right,
yeah. Big Jerome. I just like looked at him. I was like, anyone sat there, mate? He's like, no. So I'm like sat opposite Jerome. Neither of us are talking to each other. The most surreal, weirdest thing that I've ever done. But yeah, then like you have breakfast. I just rush my breakfast. And then you do like a prep day.
Yeah.
But like, you get to meet everyone, and you get to meet everyone, and you know, talk about where you're from and stuff. Do a swim test, but it's weird because, you know, rewind 24 hours. I was sat with you guys drinking red wine and eating steak,
and you knew that we were still having fun.
I know.
So go on, keep going.
But
this is what people want to hear, really.
Yeah. So you do the 24 hours. Quite simple, you know. It's so we'd planned it. I'd sat down with the producers, and we'd planned like where my bed space would be, like who I was going to be in the car with that morning, so that, you know, I'd be sat with like the less inquisitive ones or the quieter people, so that, you know, I get chance to kind of warm into kind of being
sneaky. It's like a proper undercover operation, wasn't it?
Oh, we thought about absolutely everything. Absolutely everything. So yeah, I get in the car, you do that day, and then I think the first time, so you get up that next morning, I think it was about 2:30 a.m. You stick, so Channel 4 had bought me these like Amazon waterproofs, these black ones. And I double jumpered because I knew it was going to be cold, because I knew exactly what was coming. I knew the opening scene. We'd been there on the rib. We'd like looked around. I knew it was going to be absolutely Baltic. So I double jumpered. I had a set of jeans on. Nobody double jumpers, mate. I didn't even know there was a thing called double jumper. So I knew exactly what was coming. I was trying to dress as civilian as possible. So I went for classic hoodie, jeans and trainers. Like I was oblivious to what was about to happen. You know, people turn up in outdoor clothing and all sorts. And then, yeah, you get picked up by the ribs, and it's a nighttime move at around 3:30 to a first light, almost beach assault / or is it vehicle, boat drop off?
Fast boat drop off. So just prior to this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The ribs come into the quay on the Isle of Rasse. And we then load on. So you get told what boats to load onto, and you don't really know. We don't know any of them, but obviously we knew Jay. So I've jumped on a boat with Billy, which is going to be the initial boat, because I was doing the demo of the fast boat drop off. Lo and behold, there's Jay Morton, and I'm like looking at him, and he's just looking down, looking grim.
I couldn't look at you, Foxy. No. Like, me and Foxy know each other from before the show. So like, I didn't mind looking at any other DS, but as soon as I looked at Foxy, I just knew I'd burst out in laughter, or he'd burst out in laughter.
But the atmosphere on that, I mean, that boat journey was awesome. Yeah. The weather wasn't, it was early morning. Light was just coming about, you know, the sun was just rising. We had a pod of about 100 porpoise, dolphin following the boats, and off we were. And then, yeah, we were straight into it. And that was,
I must just add, before that, when we came to pick you up, the DS up, fucking Billy just smashed straight into it, didn't he? Did you see that? I was like sat there minding my own business, and I just get a big elbow from Billy, bang. I was like, fuck, I'm a recruit, aren't I? I am a recruit.
And that was it. That was the beginning of your 6 days of utter hell.
Hell, mate, yeah. Yeah. And I must add, it was harder than I thought.
Yeah. But there was one time when obviously we got to see you every now and again, which kept you going, I suppose. You put in a great shift, and I have to say, we had to keep telling, and like, you were trying not to shine, but we had to keep saying, for fuck's sakes, Jay, just slow down.
I remember like the opening day, and we got our kit off down to our boxer shorts, and we're getting beasted, and Ant's doing his thing, shouting at us, and like, I you know, the beasting was pretty chilled. It was a few burpees, some press ups. I was actually glad of it because I was cold, I was shivering, and I was shivering but not shivering. I was trying my hardest. I was basically using absolute fucking mind control, trying not to shiver every time the camera came around,
because you knew it'd bite you in the ass.
And like, if the other recruits saw me as like the main shiverer, or like someone who shivered, I was like, and a few of them have said to me afterwards, like, mate, you don't shiver. Like, yeah, we learn it. But yeah, we get beasted. And at the time, Ollie was walking to the top of a hill, probably about 200 metres. And I was like, because I was a bit, not paranoid, but I was a bit concerned about how fit these people would be coming on. Because, you know,
we always are, though.
Yeah.
We always
are, yeah. Like, I look after myself. I'm always in shape. You know, I pride myself on, like, being able to do anything at any time and being conditioned. But, like, you never get a chance to test it against other people. So at that time, I was like, and I'd not done any training. I'd sat in Portugal for 2 weeks surfing before I went on, you know, drinking sangrias and surfing before I went on the show. So I was like, right, this is my time now to gauge where I am. And Ollie walks up to the top of this hill, and obviously I knew what was coming. And I, you know, I was probably about half, like in the middle of the park. And I was
all
like,
in their underwear, I might add. All in well.
Yeah, my red Kelvins. And I was like, right. So jogging nice and smooth. I wasn't out of breath. Got to the front and I was running nice and chilled. And I remember turning round to see where someone was behind me. Couldn't see anyone. There's no one behind me. And I like got up to Ollie. And Ollie was just, I thought Ollie was going to be like, you're right, mate, how's it going here? Just get in the squat position. He's like, fancy yourself as a fucking hero, do you? You get can... down in the squat position. I was like, oh, yes, staff.
You can always count on Ollie to bring you back down.
Yeah.
Oh, mate, it was always, I remember you did say once, you were like, God, you don't know how much power you lot have when you walk into a room, which is a bit scary. But,
it's the presence, I think.
Yeah.
You've got presence.
Mm. So, anyway, that was you as the recruit. We did the reveal, which was super exciting.
Yeah.
And it was building up for a good day and a half. And I was getting excited. It got to the point where he'd been culled for being an absolute bell end. We'd moved on from that. They'd forgotten that you even existed by this stage. Because it was a good 4 hours in, wasn't it?
I think it was about 3 hours. Three or four hours. Yeah.
And then we're all up on the sort of the podium, the dais, the stage, whatever you want to call it. And then Ant does his spiel. And at a set given time, a certain word was the trigger. You would walk up. And then I heard that gate from behind me open. I had to look at the deck because I could tell I was just going to start bursting laughing. It was horrendous.
It was tense, wasn't it?
It was tense, yeah. And there was you could tell that there was a weird, sharp intake of breath from a few of them.
Yeah.
I mean, they kept it together, if I'm honest. They did well to keep it together, but...
I remember just getting up to that day and, like, I think days 5 and 6, I was just like... Because, you know, when I say it was hard, like, I'm 36 now and I've done all that shit. I've done all that bullshit. Like, I don't want to do it again, if I'm honest. Like, I don't mind doing, you know, I enjoy doing difficult things. I enjoy going on Everest, doing these expeditions. But that's my choice.
Mm.
To then go back to the bullshit when someone scream at you.
It's like para-reg, but it's like depot.
Yeah, it's probably worse.
Recruit training, yeah.
So, like, you know, by day 5, I was over all the bullshit. well, I'd say day 1. Hour 5, I was over all the bullshit, yeah.
Excuse me.
So got to like day five and six. So day 5, I was just like, "Fuck this!" I think that's when I went to see Ant in the dock, and Ant's just like, "Mate, one more day." I had a good old chocolate bar. I think it was a Battle Ready Fuel bar, and not mentioning names, but yeah, I was like, "Fuck this!" Like day 5 and 6 just seemed to drag, which was good because, you know, it added to my cover story because I ended up being, you know, I was in a bit of a mood on day 6, didn't really want to speak to anyone, just like, you know, did the old classic, this is shit, I want to get out of here. Like, started dropping hints so that when I did finally lose the helmet.
Like a real soldier.
Yeah, yeah. I just played myself and I wasn't a factory worker from Preston. So when the time came and that helmet went diffy, missing.
Yeah.
It was quite easy. Like I was looking forward to the moment. It was tense.
We knew that you were because we were counting down the days. Like, oh, he's got 2 days left, or oh, it's the last day.
But and I knew you guys were getting good food. You were showering.
Oh, I don't know about good food.
Yeah, it wasn't that.
Didn't have a good shower though. Didn't have a good shower.
That shower was amazing.
It was awesome, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But then you transitioned. You were the turncoat. You came on and you are now the DS. And you were literally like, you came in, you'd had a wash. It got into clean clothes.
Like, literally, like, did that scene where VW, like, went into the doctor's office. They went into the accommodation. I walked out straight into one of those discoveries, straight to that hotel, turned the shower on hot. Ordered a steak, ordered a camembert, big cappuccino, and just sat there. Probably spent about 30 minutes in the shower and then walked out on stage.
Legend. Anyway, right, we're going to move on. We're not going to move on properly because what we're going to do now is I got people to send in possible questions for Jay. That was on Instagram. Now, I've been inundated with those questions, so thank you to everyone for putting those questions into me on that platform. What I'm going to do is I'm going to select some. Now, some I can't ask, not on the air. But what I can do is select, what I'm going to do is probably select about 10. And what I will do from those 10 is select the top three. And the top three will all get a free bottle of Talisker, will get sent out to them.
Boom.
Bottle of 10-year-old. The flagship of nice. Talisker's whiskey. And you'll be referred to by your Insta handle, because I obviously don't know you. Well, I might know you, but I might not know your Insta handle. So, jacob_koto.n. This is one of the questions. Are there any aspects of military life that you feel you miss out on now you've left?
Yeah, I feel like we've covered that. I think just the camaraderie. See, Tal wasn't good at school. No, just that group aspect of it.
Yeah,
I really miss that. I think it was easy for me transitioning into Through Dark.
Yeah.
Because we were all ex-Special Forces guys.
Mm-hmm.
So, gone from working with ex-Special Forces guys to... Sorry, working with Special Forces guys into working with ex-Special Forces guys.
So there's still the ethos there. It's been a lucky transition then, really, to a certain
degree.
Yeah,
not... and then, you know, I'll add to that is I do miss the job, and I miss, you know, I miss aspects of the job.
Mm.
I miss shooting, I miss training, I miss, you know, I miss doing all those things that you probably take for granted whilst you're doing them.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And now I'm out, you know, I try to spend the majority of my time doing things I enjoy, like all my hobbies, getting out in the hills. But I spend quite a bit of time in an office, and I kind of reflect on, you know, you never spend any time in the office. So when you do, you're just spinning dits and drinking brews.
Yeah. Next one is from Jashkar. It is basically best part about being the mole, and will he put out a book about his experiences? Boom.
I'd say the best part about being the mole was not being the mole at the end. I wouldn't say there's a best part of it. Do you know what? Probably it was quite interesting just getting to know all the other recruits and get to know what they're really like. And I know, yes, we turned that against them when I became the DS, but actually... that was genuine. Like, you know, I've got an interest in people, and it was interesting to get to know them all personally. And then book, I'd say so, yeah. I'd say I'll keep everyone posted on a potential book coming out. Nothing in the making yet, but...
yeah, okay, cool. We've already covered this one, Keelan. So Keelan_Faulkner. What's day-to-day like in the SAS? So just a quick, I mean, if I'm honest, I could answer this one. There's no day is the same. No. But
I guess when you're in camp, you get up, you have a bit of time to go to the gym. So between 8 and 9, go down to the gym, you parade in the office, and then you pretty much know the detail of the day. But, you know, like Foxy said, no day is different. But a day in camp might be, you go and do some training in the morning, break for lunch, go and do some training in the evening, probably finish around 2 or 3, or it can be later, eat some dinner, and then like sit around with the lads.
Cool. Nafe's lifestyle. This is a pretty good question that people, I mean, it's not up there in the top three, sorry mate, but it is interesting. What's the SAS Who Dares Wins diet? So not the DS.
Yeah, the recruits.
The recruits. We actually get quite a bit of food, but obviously we're the fucking DS, so we should do. But anyway, carry on.
You know, the food that the recruits get served is probably the hardest, or I found was probably the hardest aspect of being a recruit. So I'd say breakfast is probably a slice of cold toast, a boiled egg. There's 25 recruits. You've probably got 20 boiled eggs and probably about 13 pieces of fruit. Sometimes you get cold porridge, sometimes not. Lunch was big thing of soup and maybe a slice of bread, two slices of bread, but obviously there's not that much soup to go around everyone. And then dinner was, some of the dinners were okay, but it was mainly like some green beans, some plain potatoes, which I hate, and like a piece of shitty chicken. So, like, reduce calories.
Utter crap. Right, for next one, did I know Jay Morton while he was in the Special Forces? We were in at the same time, didn't really know him, knew of him, but we sort of crossed paths. You see people and you know people that you know each other and all this sort of thing. I got to know him more when you left and came into Froodark, really. Yeah. So that's just a bit of information for people. Hang on a minute, I'm going to choose... Right, I've chosen the three top ones. Real quick one. Actually, sorry, that was from Peter K. Vinge, I think. Ving. Sorry if I got that wrong. Last one before we go into the top three, from Jack_Bainon_03. For you, what is the hardest thing to overcome psychologically on selection?
It's a hard question. Going back to selection, I enjoyed selection. I don't think there's, you accept all the difficult aspects of it. So the lack of sleep, you sign it off and you understand that it's going to be a difficult thing to do. I never once thought about VWing. I kind of surrounded myself around people that thought the same thing. And you almost see people, don't you? You see the people that are going to VW, and you can see it in their eyes or how they are. And
yeah.
You're pretty much right every time. The next day they'll go in VW.
Right, here we go, top three. So at number three, and in receipt of a Talisker bottle of 10-year-old, we've got XLA Foster X. What advice would you give your younger self today? Standard question, but I felt it was quite good, so you get a bottle of Talisker.
Probably just I was probably quite lazy when I was growing up.
Yeah.
Probably just work harder, do more things. So, give more time for, say, hobbies or sports or meeting people, commit to doing more difficult things, get out of my comfort zone more, and trust the system and trust that everything will figure itself out.
Happy days. And in at number two, another bottle of Talisker 10-year-old. This question's from Rolful Copter Panda. So Rolf
got a question from Panda.
This is quite a good question because I've seen it come up on Instagram a lot, and I'm like, okay, I just need this question to be answered. How did you hide your Paras tattoo, which you've got on your chest, from the other recruits when you were the mole?
I've had a pound for everyone every time. Every time someone asked that question.
Even people ask me the question. Go on.
So I got my parachute regiment tattoo covered up. So there's a big skull there now. That's why no one saw
it. This is how dedicated he is to being the mole. He flew to Mallorca,
Magaluf,
and got his tattoo covered out there for this. Although you were gonna,
I was gonna get it done anyway, and this kind of just forced me into doing it.
This is number one. Again, you get a bottle of Talisker, but this had to be asked. So. The name is CLIODHNAPHELAN. So if that's you, good effort. The question is, you can't be that hard all the time. What makes your heart melt? Mate, that was always getting read out. Good effort, clear.
Chocolate.
Oh, come on.
Fucking hell. I am that hard all the time. Fuck off.
I know this is a lie. You sticking with chocolate, or are you gonna?
What makes my heart melt? Sunrises, sunsets, beautiful scenery. I don't fucking know.
I reckon we'll stick with beautiful scenery. You're that kind of guy.
Beautiful scenery.
Right, here we go. We're gonna wrap up pretty soon now, but you're cracking on with Froodark.
Mm.
You are one of the DS. What have you got? What have you got coming up this year?
Quite a busy year, really. We've got loads going on with Froodark, so. Sunday I fly out to Japan, going to film a short ski movie out there, and then hopefully I'm meeting a guy after this to talk about some ski expedition stuff in Slovenia. The big one will be K2, which I'm trying to get on or trying to raise funds for in June, July.
I mean, that's pretty busy, to be fair.
I know, time just goes so fast.
Yeah,
there's not enough hours in the day.
Quality time. Glad we got a chance to speak. Thanks for coming in.
Awesome, mate.
We'll see you soon, mate.
Cheers for having us on.
Thanks very much to Jay. Hope you enjoyed the chat. Really appreciate you listening, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks to Talisker for supporting this podcast. The lucky folk whose questions reached number 1, 2 and 3 that I read out will be getting a bottle of their excellent 10-year-old whiskey. Cheers everyone, hope to see you soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.